Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Did you hear that?
Try that again. That was weird.
I heard an echo from someone's computer.
Oh, yeah, it's very weird.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Emerge 9 Golf Podcast. Thank you for joining us as always. I am Mike Maroney alongside Jay and McLean. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me once again.
Mike, I'm doing great, by the way. I know you.
Oh, sorry, Jay. What an asshole. I didn't ask.
I'm sorry. I'm doing great. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Well,
we need to workshop this thing. Maybe we can find a focus group to help us out.
I mean, we're only 153 episodes in. We still can't figure out how to start the show.
No. It's all right though.
I think it's got some character because we just don't know what to say. And I think people are looking forward to, like, they're just hanging on pins and needles. Like, are they really going to come through and say something that's funny or witty? Probably not.
I think they lost hope a long time ago. If they listened to this podcast long enough.
Yeah, they know we're going to let you down, America.
No, I mean, I think they're coming for the letdown. They just want to see how dumb do we sound this week?
That's funny. I mean, I like dumb people.
So what are you gents sipping on tonight?
I have got I got a nice bottle from a student of mine. Corey Powell gave me a bottle called Green River, and it's I don't know a whole lot about it. I probably should have had that. Picked up, but it's actually really good. It's a pretty affordable bottle. It's like a 30 some odd dollar bottle. So just cracked it open here not too long ago. It's pretty daggone good. So
there you go.
If you can find it, give it a shot.
That's my price point. Send me a big bottle.
There. McLean, do you have any bourbon on the road? Or are you on a...
I had one downstairs at the bar. I had one Buffalo Trace before I came upstairs. But I stopped by a liquor store. I was like, you know what? I need some bourbon for the podcast. And like this little like broken down gas station liquor store. I walk in and I go back. They only have two shelves of bourbon. And I noticed the prices were extremely aggressive. I mean, $17.92 was $37. And I'm like, no, I can't bring myself to pay $11 over what I'm normally buying it for, $12 over whatever. I think I buy it for like $25 at home. And I walk over, I grab some beers, I go over, and the little Asian girl goes, were you looking for certain types of bourbon? I was like, yeah. She goes, I have some back here. She was saying, she's like, E.H. Taylor, I got Weller 12, I've got Woodford. I said, well, what's that Weller 12 going for? She goes, oh, $3.99. I don't need to know the prices of the rest of them. I'm good. I don't need to know the prices for the rest of them. Y'all are high.
$3.99?
This place is behind a gas station next door to a head shop. And another head shop next door to that. Like it was wild. The one place was literally called the Mushroom. And I'm like, what are these places? Like I'm like blowing my, and I'm like, they're like, where am I right now? What part of town am I in? I thought this was a decent part of town. And I'm like, yeah, I'm Corona Light tonight. That's fine. That'll be fine.
I miss this. Where are you?
Chattanooga.
I
usually stay downtown, but I stayed out there in Hamilton Place and a new DoubleTree, thinking that, you know, hey, this will be good. It saved a bunch of money towards budget, and I got to take some guys out to dinner this month. But then I'm just like, what is going on? So you got high priced bourbon next to a apparently a dispensary and the Mushroom. And I was like, what are these places?
Yikes.
I love it. I love it. That's great. What do you got, Mikey?
I got some Eagle Rare.
You pretentious little.
You know, I was fucking pouring it and I was like, God damn, these guys are going to give me shit about this. Like, yeah. I slummed it last week.
He only drinks nice shit. That's it.
Only. And the best part, he doesn't know how much any of it costs.
Because everyone gives him these bottles all the time. He just gets them for free from his members. It's like,
I need new friends, apparently.
I used to work for rich people.
Well, no one has ever given me a bottle of Eagle Rare. Not one bottle.
I think you've given me a bottle of Eagle Rare.
That would be nice to have somebody give me. I've given you two bottles of Eagle Rare.
You have? I've gone.
I've been to your house twice. Well, I've been to your house more than that, but I've been to your house twice with a nice bottle of Eagle Rare. That's probably the bottle that I brought you that you're drinking right now.
It probably absolutely is. It's delicious. Thank you, though. But I'm the pretentious asshole.
So, guys, if you've noticed, you know, Mike and Jay exchange bourbon. They just leave me out here in the cup.
Well, you need to move to Virginia, pal.
Buy it on my own. Sorry. The internet works, boys. You can't.
Right. Your bottle of bourbon is just with the payment from last year's DraftKings competition, too.
I would take it. Any form of currency for last year's win would be great.
Okay. All right. Where were we? Let's talk some golf, huh? That's what we're here for, right? Golf.
Where were we?
Arnold Palmer Invitational and Happy Learn to Putt. Scotty Scheffler.
Boy, did he look good.
Is your winner by 5. And Mr. Scotty Scheffler was 5th. Strokes gained putting for the week and wins by 5.
If he's in the top 10 strokes, and well, granted, this was a field of 69 players, so that's part of it. But
sure.
if he's gaining any strokes putting, then there's a good chance he's going to win.
Yeah. So he gained 4.3 and wins by 5. So even if he was dead 0 this week, he would have still won.
Yeah.
So yeah, he gained strokes. And so, yeah, what do you make? I mean, obviously that's the first place you go with Scotty in this win is he went to the mallet, which we talked about last week, which Rory is probably regretting, you know, telling him to do. And well, so I will say there was definitely one putt on Sunday he made because it was a mallet. It was the 11th hole. He hit it like 12, 15 feet below the hole. And he had that stroke. He hit it off the low heel. And the ball just held its line enough and caught the low edge and went in.
So I have a little bit of insider knowledge on this subject. Historically, Scotty has not liked an insert. He has preferred a milled face, and that is what he has always putt with. So earlier in the year, late last year, they made this virtually the exact same putter for him, but with a milled face on the putter itself. So this week, I don't know what convinced him to do it, but he went to a Sirlin insert. This is the softer of the two inserts that are offered with that putter. I don't know what got him to make that change, but the results obviously spoke for themselves. So it's unique, not only because he went to the mallet, but it's more unique because the actual insert itself is a soft insert. He's used to having, or he prefers apparently, that little bit of firmer feel of a milled face. So the fact that he went to the insert and was able to find success is more intriguing to me than, quite frankly, the move from a blade to a mallet is.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't realize he had tried the spider before with a milled face. Which that putter sounds awesome. Can I get my hands on that one?
Very limited run. It was very limited.
Like one.
No. Sold 5. I think it was 500 pieces.
Oh. Well, I mean, you've got the new designer with TaylorMade, and they're still able to add those grooves with the pure roll grooves to an insert, or not an insert, like a milled face. That's awesome. Like if they can find a way to add that and put it on a spider, like sign me up. Like that sounds awesome.
Actually, based from what I can tell, and this isn't identical, but. From what I can tell, basically they chopped the front of it off and then made a milled face and basically attached it to the putter with bolts.
Really?
You could find this putter online. It's selling for a lot of money, but Scotty didn't use it for a very long amount of time. and it was sold as a Scotty Scheffler limited edition. And then now he's putting with, other than the L-neck, you can order that exact putt. Actually, you can order, hold on, I got going two different directions. Other than the L-neck, it's a stock putter. With the L-neck, that can be ordered off of the custom site. So you can order that exact putter that Scotty's putting with right now. And it's a Sirlin insert. They offer aluminum and a Sirlin insert. The aluminum is going to be a little bit firmer. So that's why it was a little bit more surprising to me to see him go with the softer of the two inserts.
Yeah, they just went complete 180. Yeah. Well, maybe, obviously, that's what he needs.
I think he's liking the feel of it right now, would be my guess. You know, it's opening his eyes a little bit. I don't know what that sensation for him is in terms of the difference in feel and why he was able to find success with it. But on the backside of that, it does seem like this is obviously a better putter for him. Now, what we have to look out for, and obviously I'm obviously big time pro Scheffler, Spider, everything he does, all the clubs in his bag. But on the backside of that, is this a honeymoon period? Or is this long term? You know, that's what we now have to look out for. And hopefully this is long term. I'm begging for it to be long term. Because he looks extremely well. And
I think that's a great point. Not to cut you off. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Like you get that putter for the first week and you're like, wow, you haven't seen yourself miss any putts with it really yet. So you're very confident in it. You don't have any scar tissue with this new putter. So you just putt freely. There's something to be said for that. So I look at it two ways. You see guys who are great putters and they're confident in a putter that they've used before. And in some ways it limits them from trying something new. I think of like Tiger Woods is a good example, or like a Jordan Spieth. You know, like you guys have been so successful with the putter and the style that you've used. It almost restricts you from maybe trying something that could actually, that there is some game improvement there that could actually help you. And you got to respect it. I mean, they've won tons of tournaments with that style putter. So they have a lot of confidence in it. And then you go the other side to like a Scotty Scheffler, who has putted so poorly over the last 2 years with all kinds of different putters. And then you find that one putter that's new that you haven't seen before, and you start putting well, and you're like, I've never seen myself miss a putt with this putter. And then you just roll with it. And it's obviously working out, but you're right. How long does that last? How long can he sustain that? And how many tournaments does that equate to? Is it a 2-3 tournament run? Is it a, you know, 10-15 tournament run, or is it like, hey, this is it, this is what I'm using, and I'm gonna stick with it? So I venture to say that he's gonna probably stick with this one for a while, given the fact that he was playing kind of that Newport or that answer style putter forever and stuck with it even when he was putting really poorly. Mm-hmm. He just kept sticking with it and kept using it. I mean, maybe adjusting the grip size, the grip length, or the length of the putter, but not changing the style, but still having the same miss. And it's like, finally he found a putter that's a little bit different than what he's used before from a visual standpoint. And he had some success right away. I think he's going to latch onto this thing for a while, which I think could be good.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I think he should. I mean, hell, he's had more success in 1 week with this putter than he's had in a long time, 2 years with anything else. So, like, let's go, you know.
What are his strokes gained putting for the last 50 tournaments compared to this 1 week? I would venture to say that if you looked at let's just look at 2023. I don't think, if you add them all up, I think he still lost strokes total. I don't think he had hardly any positive weeks.
I mean, I'll try to dig into that a little bit.
I mean, we don't have to do it right now. I just think it's kind of a cool thing to think about. Like, you gained more strokes putting in this one tournament than you gained all of last year in 2023.
I think that's absolutely, because he's always so negative that.
Yeah.
I mean, there were tournaments that he was like -9 putting.
I think it could be the best putting week that he's ever had. I mean, again, I don't know. It's definitely in the last couple of years.
Yeah,
I mean, on Sunday he did not miss a putt inside of 15 feet.
No, it was about 16 and 16.
I think. Yeah. Good stat, Mike.
Sorry, you're upset, guy.
No, you can look at it a couple different ways. He could, you know, everyone's like, oh, wow, you think 16 feet? It was like, oh, man, he made all these 16 footers, but.
Yeah, it counts the one footer tap ins.
Yeah, it counts the one footer tap ins. And if he made 2 12 footers and then 14, you know, 1, 2, and 3 footers, I mean, it sounds great, but numbers, like, you didn't really, you know, it's not like you made like a bunch of 10 or 12 footers, like 6 or 7 of them. So it just depends on, I don't know what those links were. I didn't dig in that deeply, but all in all, like if he's putting that much better inside, because there's a lot of weeks where he would miss a ton. He'd miss more inside of 15 feet than he would make. So
yeah,
it's a good sign for sure.
If he putts like this, how many times does he win this year?
Six is exactly what I was going to say. It's exactly what I was going to say.
He's going to win almost every other event that he plays in for the rest of the year. And let's just say he plays. I was going to say 12 to 14 events. He's going to win almost every other event.
And potentially two majors with the Masters and the PGA.
Well, I mean, we're on the cusp of like Tiger Woods kind of dominance, which is so weird to even say, you know, because they're so different.
If he has a 6-win season, then I think we can have that conversation, Jeff.
No, I that's what I'm saying. I think we're on the cusp of that. Like, I'm not saying he's there yet, but I think if he putts like he's putting right now, we could see him win 6-7 times in the year, and at which we haven't seen anybody do since Tiger. I mean, when was the last time somebody won 7 tournaments in 1 year?
Yeah.
I mean, it was
Tiger. I'm looking it up right now. Yeah, it 2007 was Tiger, was the last time somebody won 7. 6 wins was Tiger in 2009, Tiger in 2005, Nick Price in 1994.
All right.
We've had a couple guys recently do 5. Jason Day won 5 in 14 and 15. Jordan Spieth won 5 in the same year, 14 and 15. Some guy named Justin Thomas won 5 in a year, 16 and 17.
What an overachiever.
Not surprising.
Overachiever.
All right, before we lose this podcast real quick, I'll bring us back in. So you have, obviously, the Masters at Augusta. We know that. We all think that course fits Scotty very well. As a past winner, if he's putting well, it's tough not to like him at that venue. The PGA is being played at Valhalla, another venue that I think would fit him very well. And then Pinehurst for the U.S. Open. It's not unrealistic to say that he could potentially knock these three majors off quickly. It's a big ask. It's a big thing to put out there. You know, in the majors, you're going to have a little bit deeper field because you'll have some of the better live players back in the events. So you'll have the likes of John Rahm, you'll have the likes of Brooks Koepka playing in these events. So, you know, the field gets a little bit deeper. Go ahead, Mike. I see you.
I think the PGA Tour needs something like this. I think we need a dominant figure. Now, he's not a dominant personality, and he can be a little boring. We've talked about that over the last couple of years. But I think we need to see a dominant player roll off a bunch of wins, have a 5, 6, 7 win season. If he can win the first two majors and then all of a sudden, like, all right, can he win the Grand Slam?
Now we got some buzz.
And the buzz just picks up, like, you know, or if he starts winning, he rolls off, he wins this week, and then he wins his next event, and he wins 3 in a row, you're like, all right, how many can he get? Can we, you know, I forget how many Tiger won in a row, and
I think he won 6.
I think
was it 6 or 7 like in a row that he won. That was the closest he came to that Byron Nelson record. Byron won 11 in a row. Yeah,
that's right.
What if he wins the Players and wins the Masters, and then wins the PGA? No one's ever won 4 majors in a calendar year, and no one has ever won all the big five. I don't even know what we call them now, but no one's ever won those, and no one's held all those titles. We've had the Tiger Slam. Although, wait, did Tiger, what year did Tiger win the, did he win in 2001? Did he win the Players' Championship in 2001? Was that when Better Than Most was that the Better Than Most? And that would be him on the tail end, but he would have already have had another major in the middle.
He did win in 01.
But when that was back when it was in the summer. So there's a major in between. Otherwise, he would have held all five of those at one time, which I guess he...
No, so he still would have.
Still would have.
It used to be in May.
Back then.
The Players used to be in May. So he won three in 01, and it's won three in 2000.
And then the Masters in 01.
He won Masters 01, and then won the Players in 01. So he owned all five at one time, I'm pretty sure.
God, that was the best run ever.
Yeah.
My bad.
That was the best run ever.
Good work if you can get it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think we could be seeing something, you know, kind of crazy. Hell, I mean, it's even a big feat if he wins this week. You know, no one's ever won the Players back to back.
Really? Oh, that's not. No, I'm not surprised. I mean,
not with this golf course, and we'll talk about it a little bit later. But yeah. It's no one's ever won it back to back. And so, I mean, he's going to finish in top five, top ten. You know, just assume it, just write it, mark it down.
Or you just completely fade him and he just blows up and shoots like and finishes 40th.
He doesn't seem to really do that though.
He does. Yeah. I was gonna say if I find a man that's gonna fade him, I want to shake his hand.
He doesn't do that. The guy just hits it so good. It's so crazy. I was watching the event with my 10-year-old and you know, we watch him hit a drive and his feet were sliding all over the place, and Trey, my son, was like, wow, did he almost fell down? Is everything okay? What happened? I'm like, that's the way he swings every time. And he's like, what? Like, don't watch that, son. Don't copy that, please.
Best
like,
in the world, son. No.
Yeah, I was like, it works for him, but I just it's not the right move.
Oh God. Any more on Scotty?
No, but let's talk about the golf course a little bit. You know, Mike, let me ask you a question. So what do we need to do to fix this golf course? I mean, you know, with rollback and everything, it's obviously way too easy. We had Andrew Putnam shoot four rounds in the 70s to finish T8, top 10 on the PGA Tour signature event, four rounds in the 70s. Where are the big issues here that you see?
Rory McIlroy driving the 10th hole. That's one.
What's also wrong? Drove it in the rough a ton and he struggled. Yeah,
what's wrong with the drivable par four? A lot of risk reward there. It's a lot to like. I mean, especially from a viewership standpoint, you love to see a guy take it over the crowd, like legit over the crowd. I mean, and I'm just sitting there watching, kind of like, is everyone just going to stand there? They're going to let this happen? I mean, look, Mike, I just wanted to get your take on it. That's all.
I actually don't like this kind of style. I like Bay Hill as a golf course. I don't like how they jack the rough way up. Like, anyone can do that. That's great. That's awesome. That's fun. Just not fun. Just
what's not fun about it?
Just watching people hack out a rough. It's not fun to me.
They hit it in the rough. Don't hit it there. Hit it in the fairway.
When you grow up the rough, it just promotes just absolutely bombing it and hitting it as far as you can because you know you're going to miss fairways and hit it in the rough, so you might as well be closer. And then around the greens, it's not fun to watch either because everyone just hacks out with a sand wedge or a lob wedge and it's one shot and you don't get to see any creativity or different shots. It's just hacking out of the rough.
So you don't think there should be a penalty for hitting it into those areas?
No, there should be. I'm not saying there shouldn't be a penalty. I'm just saying I want to see a different golf course where there's more shaved down stuff and there's what you put in short grass around greens where you can see three different players play the same shot three different ways. And
I'm okay with that.
Some guys struggle even on the PGA Tour. They struggle out of short grass. Look at guys who can't chip. They struggle out of the fairway. You know, look at a Morikawa or Hovland. They struggle when they're chipping around short grass. And then you introduce, is the guy going to hit a putter or a three wood, or is he going to bump it into the hills? Is he going to try to hit a high spinny shot? I just think it's more interesting to watch as a viewer. The style of play that I like.
I'm okay with around the greens, but I like the rough and the fairways. There's a.
I agree. I think this, 25, 30 years ago, the primary focus was on driving the golf ball in the fairway. That was like to see a guy hit 65 to 70% of the fairways and not be leading the tour and driving accuracy was not uncommon. You know, you're like, oh, you only hit 60 to 65% of your fairways. You're like in the bottom half. But now, like for a guy not to even approach 60% is they're considered one of the best drivers in the game, which again, I think that's a product of the PGA Tour and what they've set up, you know, and now they want to bring it backwards. Like you didn't set golf courses up like that in the past. And granted, we had different balls back then. We had a softer ball and you let this ball get to that point. And you took away the rough. So now you've got no rough and you promote guys to bomb it as hard as they can. And now you want to go backwards and take the speed off the ball when really, hey, let's just try to make the guys hit the ball in the fairway a little bit more. It obviously worked this week. So I'm on the fence too. I'm kind of look at it both ways. I do see what you're saying, Mike. Like you don't want to see guys hit it in the rough and then pitching it out sideways like a US Open style every time. But to have enough rough there where you can't control your ball and you can't get the ball close to the hole, and it just puts that premium on finding that fairway, finding that first cut. I think there's something there that they figured out at the API.
Yeah, and I will touch on that as well. I mean, I think having more closely mowed collection areas around the greens does offer more creativity, and I'm for that. I'm absolutely for that. Now, I also think that does
in favors more skill.
I totally agree with that. I think it does have to, it's slightly dictated by the golf course and the design. Are the greens more raised or is it all flat around it? Because a lot of the Bay Hill greens is pretty much flat around there. So the only penalty you have is to have some rough there and introduce, you know, a little bit of a tougher golf shot, because otherwise you just have guys just hitting bump and runs all day and, you know, just getting up and down nonstop. But I think that the thought of, because there's kind of a middle ground there in terms of looking at the rough being longer, so everyone's trying to bomb it as far as they can. If they bomb it as far as they can, but they can't advance it to the green, then it makes accuracy a larger point of what they're doing off the tee. Now, all of a sudden, I need to hit this fairway if I have any chance of making birdie, because if I hit it in the rough off the tee, par is going to be a good score. So yeah. I like that aspect of it as well, because I think that's a fair penalty. I think that's how it should be viewed at, especially for players of this caliber. I'm not talking about every day of the week for the random member to be out there playing, but I do think that having a penalty there to where, yeah, you can go ahead and hit driver, but once you get up there, if it's in the rough, buddy, you might not be able to control what the golf ball does out of there. You might not be able to advance it to the green. If you do advance it to the green, it's going to be very difficult to hold the green. And in some cases, you're going to have to lay up short, because that also introduces some creativity to the point to say, all right, my ball's in the rough. This is the lie I have. I need to take, instead, this is a stock pitching wedge yardage, but I need to take kind of a knockdown 8-iron and land it 15 feet short of the green and let it run up. So I think there's some creativity there that could be argued for as well. On the backside of that, I just think it's something that we need to make accuracy, you know, more of a premium factor in the game. And I think rough allows us to do that, especially on a lot of these venues that we have. That to me kind of mitigates that distance argument.
Had this come into a rollback discussion. Like, you hijacked
we
this.
Haven't said, we haven't said
total, rollback. It was a total hijacking. That was not on the agenda. You never offered this on the agenda. Not like you guys ever offer anything on the agenda, but just a complete total hijacking.
I just think there's a lot of valid points made there.
I think I made some too. But USGA can't regulate course setups. They don't control course setups. They control it one tournament a year for the professionals.
And that's the tournament that most often has been criticized for allowing the setup to get away from them.
You're right. Yeah, they've messed up a bunch there. I won't.
So if we acknowledge that aspect of it, why do we allow them to continue to change the rules of the professional game?
I don't know, because they're the ones in charge.
Merely a question. That's not an argument. That's just looking at it and say, you know, because it wouldn't be realistically, the PGA Tour could simply say, all right, guys, we're going to have our own set of rules out here.
No, the PGA Tour can't say that, because one of the PGA Tour's defenses is they don't want bifurcation. So they can't do that.
If you look at every other professional sport, there's no third party dictating the rules of the game.
Okay, but everyone says they're against bifurcation. I was for bifurcation. And I was told I was an idiot.
Why don't we?
Now everyone's for bifurcation. Did like I said, then everyone's fine.
I'm not for bifurcation. Let me be very clear with that. I'm not for bifurcation. But I would be pro on saying that the PGA Tour is now the leader in the rules of golf. I don't know the best way to say this, but ultimately they're the preeminent party to say that these are the rules that the PGA Tour plays by. And I would like to see other entities follow suit.
I don't really want to go down this rabbit hole tonight.
Yeah. All right. No worries.
Because I don't know. The PGA Tour shouldn't be in charge of anything if they've proven anything over the last 2 years. They can't get their own tour straight, never mind the rules of golf. So I don't want Jay Monahan and these players dictating what the rules of golf are.
There's some validity there, Mike. That's validified. I'll give you that.
Why would they be? Why do they have they proven any track record better than the USGA over the last 2 years?
I don't disagree with that, but I think in every other professional sport, the rules are being dictated by the professional sport. Yeah, so I just think there's a lot of differences
in golf than there are versus other professional.
100%, 100%. But I think that's an interesting thing to quack. You look at it and say
that's because you can't be 75 years old and go play football and line up as middle linebacker and stuff to run. Like, just doesn't happen. We have 76 million people in this world that play golf till they're dead. Somebody's got to create rules for the whole game, not just the professional game.
Do you think the
USGA? I think the USGA has made too many rules for the average public based off of the 1% of the 1%. I think that's where they've gotten in trouble. And again, that's why I'm for bifurcation. I know I'm in a minority there. But the professional game and the amateur game are very different in this sport. If the USGA wants to make rules for amateurs and amateurs only, fine. And if the PGA Tour wants to make rules for professionals only, fine. Then everyone's got to get off their high horse about, oh no, this is a cutesy. We all got to play by the same rules. It's not the same game. So why are we policing it the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you in the I don't want bifurcation either. But I understand that, like, if that's the next best scenario, then let's do that. I think rolling the ball back for everyone is the worst case scenario. I think that's bad for golf in general. If you do bifurcate and you have a separate set of rules for the professionals, it's still kind of dumb. I don't really love it, but it's better than a full rollback for everyone. I think that's the worst case scenario. But to McLean's point, I think there's still some hope there to challenge these professionals in a way that they have not been challenged in the last 25 years to say, hey, I'm not saying you have to play at U.S. Open conditions, because there's a lot of different grasses. There's a lot of different ways to make the golf course tough. And I think by narrowing some of the fairways just a little bit and raising the rough height, just a little bit, now we can put a little bit more pressure on these guys driving the golf ball, being a little bit more accurate. And it's not so much to where it's like we're watching guys hack it out sideways like we would at Bethpage Black or something like that. I don't think that's fun for anybody to watch every week. It is fun to watch once a year, but if we can just raise the standard up a little bit, I know the PGA Tour standard to have these fairways the most firm conditions they possibly can have, and guys hitting balls, if they do it the fairway, they're hitting at 350. But now if you throw a little bit of rough in there, if they're not going to back off of how firm the fairways are and how much run they get, grow the rough up another inch, just enough to where if you hit a good drive and it just hops into the, just over the first cut and you get in the rough, you're like, man, I hit a good drive there. I only got 130 yards, but I have no way to get close to this, you know, front right pin over this bunker with a pitching wedge. I've got to try to hack it out to the left and have a 30 footer. So we don't have that. Guys can make birdie from 130 yards out of the rough that they play at predominantly on the PGA Tour. It's not a problem. So I think you don't have to make a complete total shift, but just altering just a little bit, well, I think we'll kind of merge the gap here for a little bit longer. And worst case scenario, they bifurcate and have a separate set of rules and balls for the PGA Tour players. But the absolute worst case scenario would be which is what's been
proposed,
to play the same ball. I think that's, or to roll the ball back, I think is just awful for golf in general.
The USGA just can't regulate course setups though.
Yeah.
They have no say. So they would have to rely on the PGA Tour to alter course setups. So it's a PGA Tour. Again, I don't trust them to do that either. And
well, but again, the USGA doesn't care about the PGA Tour. The PGA Tour can do whatever they want. The USGA is talking about, you know, what are we doing for just golf in general? So if you want everyone to play faster and get around faster, then you have no rough and make the game easier. Sure. Like, I mean, if that's your only goal, then that's what we're going to do. We're going to cut the rough down. It's going to be mowed down. Everyone gets around, but if you want to make the game a challenge and you want to make it, you know, really test people, then obviously then that's what they have to do on their side of things. But the PGA Tour, I mean, they're going to do whatever they want regardless. I think it's just, that's when it comes to the point where they both have to get on the same page, and where we've all kind of agreed, like they need to come together and figure it out, and make sure they're all on the same page. I mean,
I agree with you, Jay. Ship sailed. I agree with you. I think that ship has sailed. I don't know what it would look like, but I would like to see one single entity running the game of golf, not have the USGA and the PGA Tour being separate entities. And
well, again, it depends on what you call the game of golf.
Well, put it this way. If you looked at it and said, because if the PGA Tour made their rules, the anchoring ban would have never happened and rollback would have never happened. None of the tour players thought that this was a good idea on either of those decisions.
Of course, but
on the back side of that, I don't know what the ideal scenario is. I just wish there was one ruling body that did everything. And I think ultimately, if you take the professional game into consideration,
well, there is one ruling body that does it all. You just don't like them.
No, but all right. So yes, that is correct.
Okay, there's two, but they work in unison: the RNA and the USGA.
Right. I just wish that you could, and I don't have the perfect scenario for saying this. I don't know if it's having a players union, a board of directors, and everyone has to kind of go back and forth and take votes on what things need to look at. And again, I don't know how that would shake out. I mean, this is pure speculation. On the backside of that, and getting off of this, so let's take this out of this conversation. As I know Mike will certainly enjoy. The one thing I will say I liked about the API setup is that you had Scottie Scheffler win, who's one of the longer players in the game. T4, you had Russell Henley. T6, you had Brendan Todd. And T12, you had Brian Harman. So having accuracy be such a big part of being successful on this golf course proved that now you can introduce more players into the competitive zone. And I thought that was, I'm looking at this leaderboard, I like the breakdown. It's not all bombers up top. This didn't take Brian Harman out of the golf tournament because he can't hit it 350. This didn't take Russell Henley out of the golf tournament because he can't hit it 350. It was a difficult test of golf, and ultimately the best players all were able to succeed regardless of what distance looked like.
And we're going to see that this week as well. This is one of the
equal
one of the toughest weeks to kind of predict score here. I mean, we see short players with great iron games. We see short players that are great putters. We see long players that are not great putters. We've seen, you know, decently long players that have really good, solid, balanced games across the board win. I mean, we've seen every single type of winner at this tournament. I don't know. I mean, it goes to show how intricate the design is, and you know, also with how Dai likes to trick people visually. I think that's another part of it. That's another aspect.
Deception.
He is. I love him or hate him, he's good at it. Mm-hmm. And he can have you looking to one side of the fairway, thinking you're hitting into the junk, which really that's the wider part of the fairway, or vice versa. You know, you feel like you're looking into the woods, and all the fairway is off to the other side of the fairway, or the hole, and it's just, and you never know. It's not like it's a common thing. Like he changes it up. He's got the bulkhead that messes with you, and he's very good with eye lines. Like visually, what you can see, like you can't see the bulkhead, and then you think you're fine, and then you can see the bulkhead, but really it's not in play. Like it's pretty crazy. It's pretty clever. I mean, I know he has been deemed one of the kind of, you know, mad scientists when it comes to architecture, and a lot of people don't really agree with it. And it's not maybe, if you compare him to some of the older designers of Ross and Tillinghast and, you know, those guys, he doesn't fit that mold, but he's got his own style. And this golf course obviously proves that it's not a one-track pony or type of player that wins. So I do respect it. And I think I respect his wife more than anybody, because I feel like she like had her hand in this thing a lot with all of his work, which is kind of cool.
A lot of it. I've always liked Dai courses. I've never really had major issues. I think as long as you know what you're getting into ahead of time, I think if you have someone that have never heard of Pete Dai, doesn't know what a Pete Dai golf course is like, knows nothing about golf course architecture, and you drop them into a Pete Dai golf course, they're probably going to walk away not liking it. I've always kind of enjoyed every Dai that I've played. I've never had major issues with them. I want to talk Rory real fast. Let's go back to Bay Hill.
Mm-hmm.
What's up with him?
Yeah, I mean, he had such an incredible year last year in terms of just consistent play. Obviously, he didn't win a whole lot, but I mean, if you look back, I mean, he's finishing the top 10 like every other event. He just looks off. Something's not quite right. Like he just can't find that rhythm.
He's driving it like a fucking madman. I'm trying to pull up his stats here. Yeah, he's first strokes gained off the tee. And he's 152nd approach.
Yeah, but it's showing his weakness. I mean, the weakest part of his game right now, obviously outside of putting, is from 150 yards and in. Like, I mean, generally speaking, I mean, you can chop that down into 25-yard increments. But if you go from 150 to 75 yards, which is the bulk of what shots he has into par fours, he just struggles. I mean, he played the par fives really poorly this week too. So I don't think he drove it as well as he normally has in the past. I mean, he played the par fives over par, I think. So that's probably attributed to him hitting the ball in the rough a little bit more and not having accessibility to get the ball or the club on the ball.
He was second off the tee this week.
Strokes gain
off the tee. He was second.
But what were his accuracy numbers? I mean, what did he score? He played the par fives really poorly. I mean, again, those strokes gain off the tee is
66%.
So do they calculate the strokes gain off of like proximity to the hole off the tee, or is, And that's it, great. Like if he's bombing and he's close to the hole, but he's in the rough and he can't get the club on the ball to get close to the hole, like, are you really gaining any strokes?
Well, that factors into it, where he hits it in the yardage out. And obviously if you hit it 150 yards away from the hole in the rough, I hit it 150 yards away from the hole in the fairway, I'm gaining more strokes there than you.
Yeah.
So it's not only just yardage, but there's also yardage and are you hitting in the rough? Are you hitting out of bounds? Are you hitting in a fairway bunker? All that's factored into it. But it does skew a little bit to the longer driver, because strokes gain, the way the game of golf is played now, Sometimes 120 yards in the rough is better than being 150 yards in the fairway.
Yeah.
But I think I agree. And I think without going too deep into how strokes gained works, there's something to be said for not being able to have that ultimate control over the ball and out of the rough. Like, let's just say you have 70% of the time out of the rough. On most golf courses, you have control over your ball. But when you go to Bay Hill, you only have control of your ball 55% of the time. So the strokes gain numbers start to get skewed a little bit. And it also depends on type of player that, you know, if you've got a player who is very steep out of the rough and can get the ball up and out of the grass, which Rory shouldn't really have a problem with that. But again, I mean, I think the numbers are not quite as accurate. And like, oh, you gain X amount of strokes off the tee because you hit it 340, but you're in the rough. Like, so if you have a guy who hits at 310 in the middle of the fairway, he's still 30 yards behind you. But
no, I agree, because it doesn't, especially on short game and putting, it doesn't factor in like the conditions. Like a 20 yard pitch, there's not a 20 yard pitch, it's the same. If you're 20 yards above the hole and you're landing on a downslope and it's fast greens, it's way different than you're a 20 yard pitch and you're looking straight up the gut and there's no break and it's landing in an upslope and it's going to check easy. Like that, those 20 yard pitches are not the same. Now, strokes gain can't.
I mean, we're going with the best thing that we have. And again, strokes gain, you know, you're calculating somebody who's hitting it. You know, they've got 150 yards out of the rough, and you don't know what that lie looks like. You're just saying rough, but I don't know how difficult that lie is. Are you hitting it into the side of the fairway that they've raked the rough back at you? I know that the API doesn't do that, but in US Opens they do. Like, I'm hitting it on the right side of the fairway, which most guys will miss it. They rake the rough back towards you, so you're hitting into the green. If you maybe hit it down the left side, you know, now you're hitting into the green. Like, those are weird little things that strokes gain doesn't calculate. So, but back to Rory, like, again, I don't know. Something's off, you know, when it comes to that. Like, I just still don't think he's hitting the ball straight enough. He's hitting it long enough, but I don't think he's hitting it straight enough, which is certainly not helping his mid to short iron play, which we know he struggles with. He has struggled with his mid and short irons for a long time. Okay. And I don't really know. I mean, I watch it. I've got my own opinions on what's going on. I'm not going to, you know, go into his swing theory with him. It's hard to do that on a podcast, but I do think that he's got some flaws. And I think I think that what he's got going on with the swing, it sounds like some of the things he's tried to work on. I think he gets the club a little open. I think he gets a little too steep, in my opinion, for him and on the backswing. And then he's trying to kind of play catch up on the downswing, and it makes it very difficult for him to control the loft. You know, I always think about the loft of the club. Like, the guys who really are great short iron and wedge players, they control the loft really well. The guys who are great long iron players, they take advantage of speed and adding loft. And they don't necessarily have to be as accurate because they're swinging so fast, they can add a lot of spin. So you look at someone like Rory, who can add loft or keep loft on a 5-iron, and he swings it faster than everybody else. So he can spin it as much as anybody with a 5-iron. So now his misses aren't as great because he spins it so much. But now you take the same player with the same swing, you give him a short iron, he's going to spin it too much and not have control over loft. So now with the short irons, you've got loft that now you've got a directional problem too, and now you've got a spin control problem. And I think, you know, with, like I said, not trying to make this too complicated, but I think he has problems maintaining like more of what I would coin this term, true loft, where he's not manipulating the face so much and trying to save it all the time. You look at the best way I can describe this, look at Rory's swing with a wedge, and then look at Steve Stricker's swing with a wedge. Look at Zach Johnson's swing with a wedge. There's the face is very stable for a long time. Now, they don't swing it as fast, but it's like the face stays very stable all the way through the hitting area. And these guys are the best that ever lived when it comes to wedge play. And I think Rory struggles with that. He just gets the club in some positions that he's using his hands too much, and it just makes it difficult. So,
yeah, he always loops it and drops it under too far for a, for a wedge too. It's good to launch a 5-iron in the air, but not so much to.
Which is again why he's always going to be in the mix. Like, as long as he hits it, as good of a long iron player, average wedge player, average putter, I mean, top 10 every time. And if he has a great week where he's putting good and hitting his wedges good, he wins. Which we haven't seen a whole lot. Haven't seen a whole lot of that recently. But
no, I mean, his 4 finishes on the PGA Tour. Now, he won over in Dubai. Did he win in Dubai? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he won in Dubai. Mm-hmm. But his 4 on the PGA Tour so far: T66 at AT&T, T24 at the Genesis, T21 at the Cognizant, T21 at the API. So hasn't had a top 20 yet.
He's talented enough, and he's got enough of a track record where you're always the second we all like, okay, Rory's playing bad. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if he wins this week. Just, you know, he's the type of guy who can go 66th, 30th, 21st, 21st, and then win the players. Like, he can do that where other guys can't. Like, they have to be trending. Play themselves into the win, and he doesn't have to do that. Which, that's why everyone likes watching him.
All right, so one last topic from Bay Hill. What did you guys make of the whole Wyndham Clark controversy, if you will, that his ball moved in the rough when he was putting the club behind it? You know, and this kind of goes to a theme we've seen with a couple issues in the last couple of years of guys, you know, are they patting the rough down, you know, putting a couple of different clubs there? Are they improving the lie? Is the ball moving? Is it oscillating? Is it just kind of rocking in place? I didn't see it live. I don't know. I think the ball moved a little bit, but I don't think it was.
Yeah, no, I'll comment on that. I think it's a product of, you know, us having cameras on every single ball and the players that are playing great. And every single person that's listens to this podcast or has played golf has put their club behind the ball in the rough, and the ball has moved from its original position. And meaning, if the ball is suspended on top of a couple blades of grass, you put your club behind it and the ball sinks a half inch, essentially you should take a penalty. You should take a penalty for the ball. You're not playing the ball from the exact same position. And I think that's kind of bullshit. Like, it goes back to the rules of golf are set in place to make sure that someone is not taking advantage of the system or the rules and trying to gain an advantage. So if you put your club behind a ball in the rough and your ball settles like a half inch, not because you're trying to pat your club behind the ball to try to get it to move down, but if it happens, it's like, where's the advantage? Where you look at it from like a Patrick Reed standpoint, when his ball's in a waste bunker and he puts his club behind the ball and then is sweeping away sand. Now that's an advantage. That was
the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life.
It really is. I mean, and there's some intent there. Like, you don't do that like multiple times without like, hey, I see that I got a bad lie here. Let me just ground my club and then move the sand away. But for the ball to nestle in the rough, I get it. By the rules of golf, it is a penalty. The ball has moved from its original position. So even suspended in air or not, it's moved. So it should be a penalty. But again, I think we can sit here and watch HD cameras and we can say, oh, the ball moved a lot. But if you look at it in real time, it's like, man, I couldn't even really tell that moved. Did it move like a quarter of an inch? Like, and it's like a quarter of an inch. Like, what is this player gaining from this ball nestling down a quarter of an inch?
So I'm looking at it right now. This is the first time I've seen it. And when he puts the club down in the grass, it does seem like the ball moves slightly. But it also looks like as he pulls the club away, the ball kind of returns to that spot.
Yeah, it almost kind of rocks.
Well, yeah. It almost like it raises back up once the pressure of the club being down into the grass is relieved. So I'm with Jay on this. My biggest thing is intention.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to ground the club behind the golf ball, which is what every one of us would have done in that exact same situation. There was no malice intent in what he did. That's where I have a hard time sometimes with some of these rules to say, all right, if you have malice intent, if you go in there and intentionally try to improve your lie, penalized 100%. Mm-hmm. If you merely try to ground the club, it's somewhat similar to what happened with now, you know, the grounding the club in the hazard rule used to be. You're pulling the club back and, you know, striking an object that was within the hazard used to be penalized. Again, no negative intention was featured in those moments, and that's why they made that change to the rule. This particular situation looks very, very similar to that. For ultimately, it's like, all right, I need to judge this lie. What's it look like when I get my club behind the golf ball? And because the rough is tall, you do see some movement in the rough. The ball is obviously suspended an inch or so above the ground, a half inch. I can't possibly measure that without having been there. But on the backside of that and looking at it, I keep looking at it over. Yeah, you do see the ball. But the best part about it, when we talk about whether or not the guy should be penalized, the ball went deeper into the rough when he put his club behind it. It's not like he put the club behind it and he lofted it up to the top of the rough to where he'd have a much easier lie. The lie, if anything, got more difficult. So to penalize a guy in that instance where he's merely trying to ground the club behind the ball, which is 100% allowed inside of, or at this point, almost damn near anywhere on the golf course.
Anywhere but the bunker.
So, no, I don't think he should be penalized at all. Do I think the ball shifted slightly? Yes. Do I think it shifted to a more positive location? No. Do I also think that when that club was raised, that ball returned to damn near the exact same spot? I do. So I'd have a hard time getting behind people that are wanting to penalize for this. You will get your, you know, hardline rules guys that think, oh, the ball moved, we got to penalize them. Is that good for the game?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Mm-mm.
Hey, McLean, you're a big fan of the Heritage or the RBC. That makes me think of, is it Brian Davis? Was that his name? Brian Davis?
Yeah, Aldi.
Took the penalty. It was in the hazard on the 18th hole.
Off to the green.
And hit what at the time was a loose impediment, which was a reed in the grass, and he called the penalty on himself.
And that was in a playoff.
The playoff. And he lost the golf tournament because he called the penalty on himself because he hit a loose reed on the backswing. And he said that I hit a loose impediment, which is a penalty. And I'm like, geez. I mean, he did, by the rules of golf at that time, he did the right thing. But it was like, what? Like, if this is what it's come to, like, what are we doing? Like, that's
not happened to somebody at the Kiowa, too. The year Rory won at Kiowa. Same thing. I mean, Rory won by a million there, so it didn't affect the tournament, but the same kind of thing. The guy like moved a leaf in a hazard, you know.
Yeah. It's like
there's not one player that saw that happen with Brian Davis and was like, all right, this is how I wanted this tournament to end.
Yeah.
One viewer. There's no one that was there in such a climactic situation to where all of a sudden they're like, all right, I'm glad it ended that way. He shouldn't have done that. No. Yeah. No one wanted to see that. Yeah. It does show the incredible amount of integrity that Brian Davis has. Because I don't think anyone else would have really caught that. If they did, it would have been Monday morning on Golf Central. But he'd already collected a check by that point. But he called it on himself. And I think that's just such a bad rule. I think this is very similar, especially now. This is what I look at. When you have this amount of cameras on something, which obviously they have a camera on the golf ball as he puts his club down before he's even getting ready to hit a golf shot. That's crazy to even think that exists, right? But we have that, and that's where professional golf is. In this moment, you need to be able to go and look at intent. What was his intention? Was this something that he was strategically trying to reposition his lie for an advantage? Or was this something that happens during the normal course of the game, to where you set a club behind the golf ball to try and judge your lie a little bit? Because we've all done that. Everyone on this podcast, all three of us, have set a club behind it. You got a kind of a squirrely lie. You get up there, you put the club kind of behind it. Like, all right, how do I need to play this? What's the face angle? What's the lie look like?
Yeah.
How much air is there underneath this golf ball? And you're trying to judge on how you can actually execute this golf shot. That's what he was doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, do we go as far as saying changing the rule to did you improve your lie? You know, I think that opens up some gray area, though. You know, thinking about it, you know, it's hard to determine that. Like every time a ball moves in the fairway, in the rough, on the green, you know, then the question is going to be, well, and did you improve your lie? Well, no, I didn't improve my lie. And then you have the conversation about, is the lie better than where it was before?
And I think that's why they're trying to get the gray area out and just black and white.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's what makes it tough.
I agree with you guys though. No, that.
Well, we can have the same discussion and, you know, about divots in the fairway. We've heard that a lot. Like you hit a ball right down the middle of the fairway and your ball's in a divot and you're like, wait a second, should I be able to move my ball out of a divot? And then the conversation on every hole will be, what's a divot? Like, is my ball, it's like, I've got this is an old divot. It's a light impression, but it's sitting down. I'm pretty sure this is a divot. Now you're sitting there with your playing partners and caddies and you're calling rules officials over. Like, is this ball sitting in a divot? And that slows the whole game down as well. So,
yeah, like I'm under the, from that standpoint, before I don't want to get on this point for too long since we've got some other things to get to, but I would like it. It's never going to happen in the case of what you just said, but I do think you should get relief from a divot because not everyone plays the golf course in the same conditions on a given day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but it's so hard to police because what's a divot for what you just said. So yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. But yeah, there's some other,
if they wanted to do it, sorry, I know we want to move on, but yeah, if they wanted to do it, the language in the rule book would have to be very direct. Like it's got to be obvious, you know, very strong language about what a divot is. If your ball is in a divot, and a divot is this, a ball that's in a hole that with no grass, yada, 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 something to like really define this so it's obvious. And if we get to a point where, you know, you have to call a rules official over, you know, once a week or once a tournament to clarify, then we would do it. But something would have to be written to make it really strong. So, but I agree with you, Mike. I think it. We've got so many rules that protect players that hit balls out of play, and you've got, you know, piles for removal. You've got burrowing animals. You've got dangerous animals, dangerous insects. You've got so many other rules that people take advantage of. Yet you hit a ball right down the middle of the fairway, and you hit it right in a divot of somebody previous to you, and like that person played the hole right before you and hit from a perfectly clean lie, and now you just happen to be playing later, and you hit it right into that person's divot. You're like,
especially when you find like, you know, a short par four where everyone's kind of laying up to the same spot, or a par five where everyone's laying up to the same spot, or you get these big collection areas that balls run into, and it's like, I don't know, just because you got stuck with the last two time of the day, and you had 150 guys before you know. Play the golf course, and there's now 50 more divots in that one spot because of the design of the hole, or you know, whatever it is. It's like, I don't know, that doesn't seem right. The first guy of the day had a massive advantage over me.
Yeah,
but yeah, and I know that's part of the game, different draws, and you know, you get bumpy. You know, I guess they just fixed the spike mark rule, so that makes it a little easier on the greens, but still.
Yeah.
All right, a couple other things. Rory made some comments. Wyndham Clark, actually both guys we just talked about, made some comments about restricting cards, making the tour smaller, 100 players. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of what we have a little bit.
Stupid. I think it's stupid.
Yeah, I think generally I think it's stupid. I actually don't mind the system that it is now with these elevated events. I think they've made it a little harder to keep your card with only 70. They get into the playoff, they get the automatic card, and you can play your way, the Jake Knapps of the world, the Matthew Pavons of the world, the Justin Lowers of the world can play themselves into these big signature events, you know, over a few weeks stretch of good golf and winning an event, or just high finishes in Lowers' standpoint. I kind of like how it's set up, in all honesty. I think it benefits the top players, because they're top 50 in the world, they're going to get, or top 50 in the FedEx Cup or whatever it is going to get into these events. A lot of them are no cut and they're big purses and a lot of FedEx Cup points. But there is opportunity for the Cinderella stories, the guys that make their way and change their life. And I want to see exactly at the end of the year, how is the churn rate of cards and what percentage of guys fell out of these big events? What kind of guys got into them? Are we getting enough turnover there? But to just go to 100, I don't know. I think it's in an okay place right now. If we can just get everyone playing on the same tour, it would be great. But I think it's an okay place right now.
Yeah, I agree. I don't like shortening. I don't like making the field size smaller. That makes it too easy. No pressure. I think people lose interest. I mean, this week, the API, we watch it because we like golf. I mean, there was still a cut to 50 in ties and or within 10 shots of the lead, 69 guys. So there still is a little bit of, focus there on Friday. But all in all, I don't know. I don't get up for the smaller events as much as I do for the big events with a cut. It makes me watch golf Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But like for these invitational events, so-called invitational events where there's no cut or I would call it a minimal cut. Although a lot of top players did miss the cut with only, 15 guys missed the cut. And there was some guys, big names that missed the cut, Morikawa, Fleetwood and so forth. But I don't like it. Like I don't like watching these guaranteed events. It's not fun for the viewer. Like I'll check in on Sunday, but like I'm not really watching on Friday. It doesn't matter. But when like the players, I'll watch Friday because there's going to be some big names that are trying to make the cut, and that could be the difference. Like there's been plenty of guys that have made the cut on the number or by one or two that have had a great weekend and gotten contention. And there's more players, more stories, more people to root for. So I'd completely disagree with Rory, which I don't know. Rory's he's pulled a 180. He's slowly dropping down on my list. I don't know what it is. I'm not a fan of the comments. I'm not a fan of it. It seems like Rory's all about Rory now. I kind of actually appreciated him taking a stand for the greater good of the PGA Tour. And now it's like, yeah, whatever. Let's go to less guys playing, less cards. I want more money. Like, of course you do. Cause you're a top, top tiered player in the world. You're going to always be up there cause you're a great player. So of course you want that. Like, why?
Yeah. He was saying it was going to be more cutthroat. And I get, he's trying to say it's gonna be more cutthroat to make, to keep your tour card. But if it's only 100 guys, how many guys lose their card? And it's easier to win a golf tournament. I think 156 man field is more cutthroat than 100 man field.
100%. 100%. So, yeah. I mean, if you're giving away 50 cards, every year and the 100 guys keep their card and your 50 guys lose their card. Okay. I mean, yeah, I could see that. They're not going to do that because that's not good that's not good for their brand. That's not good for marketing. You don't want to have 50 guys losing their card out of 100.
Yeah, you'll have a handful of the most popular guys not keep their card.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that I dislike about this, under the PGA Tour's current format, one of the things that we used to see is, kind of your long-term guy that was very successful for many years, that still gets in events, have the ability to make a resurgence in a top event. You take a guy like you look at Ryan Palmer, for example.
God, I almost said it before you said it.
Guy who's won a bunch, guy who has had a very successful PGA Tour career. And, he's trying to make that comeback. And for example, API might have been a tournament that he's had some success from previously. All of a sudden, he's not able to get out there. He's able to win the golf tournament without question. No one would take that away from him because he's done it before. He gets under pressure. he's not going to view it the same way that a guy who's trying to win for the first time is. I'm not saying totally correct. I'm just looking at the scenario to say that there's a lot of times where we've seen guys that have had some rough years. They still have their card. They still get in all the events because they're, you know, 120th or whatever it is. But all of a sudden now they're able to go out there and play good golf because they know how to do it. Once you're back in the saddle, you're in that saddle.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan Palmer is a guy that if he's in contention, no one's questioning whether or not he's nervous. He still is able to get the job done. So this kind of takes away from that particular, you know, genre of players being able to do so.
Limiting the field to 70 or less. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
The one thing though, I'll push back a little bit on that is I think the PGA Tour caters too much to the past winners, career money list exemptions, all these has-beens, for lack of a better term. I don't know if you follow the story. There's a lot of Korn Ferry Tour guys that graduated, Korn Ferry graduates that are having a hard time getting in fields this year and getting starts because there's so many of these, you know, past winner exemptions and categories and all that. I think they need to reshuffle these categories. I'm a little bit more for the future of the game and these young guys that are on the Korn Ferry Tour and making it and getting them some starts and figuring out the Ryan Palmers of the future, not Ryan Palmers of the past, you know, just to use him as an example.
Yeah, I think those two takes kind of go hand in hand. I mean, you can look at them, you know, from two different perspectives, but I think they both kind of co-align. You know, McLean is saying we need to have, you know, more of these guys, you know, more of an opportunity for the guys who have had some experience, but in your take, you know, more guys who are new to the game. And neither one of those guys are going to benefit from the setup that we have right now, 70 players or less. If they continue to move to that, like, you're not going to get new guys playing in those events. You're not going to get the old past champions to play in those events. And again, I think the more players in each event and the better the players are in each event, the more viewership. There's more people to pull for. There's more people to root for. Like, hey, I want to see Ryan Palmer. Man, I've loved watching this guy for the last 20 years. I like watching these old journeymen play. Or, man, I know this young guy. You know, my family's friends with this Korn Ferry graduate. I want to see him play well. But when you start, you know, limiting the field to 70 players, you lose viewership. Like, every time somebody turns on the TV to watch golf, there's a 156-man field. There's some reason that they're pulling for one of those players. And when you take that away, then you lose viewership. So in my opinion, more money for the top 70 players, you're decreasing the interest. Less and less people are going to have a reason to watch. So I think they keep the full fields. I think they get rid of the stupid, you know, 70 man. You know, I know they think that's a sponsorship. That's sponsorship gold because you're going to get the best players to play on the weekend. And I get it to a certain extent, but the full field events, just, I mean, look back, look, we never had these events like 25 years ago. This all started in the
144 man no cut.
Yeah, it was either 144 or 156 every week. And it was like you had to make the cut every week. And then not to take anything from Tiger, obviously it was the craziest streak that you've ever seen. But I don't go back and look at how many of those events were no cut events that they counted, you know. Granted, he was going to probably make the cut anyway because he was winning. So I don't want to take away from that. But there is a chance that if there were, you know, say there's a couple that he made the cut by only a couple shots or, you know, maybe didn't play well the first two rounds and then lit it up on the weekend and finished in the top five. There were some events like that. So I don't know. I just think the full field events, it's just, there's something to be said for winning or competing in a full field event. And I think the viewership goes up when you have more people playing, they have more of a reason to watch. And when we start to dilute the waters a little bit, when we drop it down to, you know, 70, 60, 50 man fields, which we've all said, you know, same thing with that's the argument with the LIV Tour, you know, and world ranking points is like, okay, it's not a full field here. Like, it's not even close. So Now, granted, there's some really top-notch players playing, but still,
yeah,
you just it's limited.
Lastly, PGA Tour related. I don't even know if I really want to spend any time on this because it's kind of pointless. But Monahan has bring press conference
anyway.
Today.
Yeah, bring it up anyway.
Monahan had his press conference today. I don't know if you guys caught any of it or heard any of the.
Yeah.
It was a big fat nothing burger. He said pretty much nothing. There's a new policy board. We forgot to mention this last week. There's a new policy. They added some board members, and then there's the new board of the PGA Tour Enterprises. And frankly, I'm fucking sick of talking about PGA Tour boards and all this kind of bullshit.
There's like a bunch of boards.
I really just don't care. Just really don't care. Monahan said nothing. I don't think this deal is close. And the biggest takeaway I took from this is they need to get him a taller chair because when he had his elbows on the table, it looked weird. And this is coming from a short guy, so I understand. I've sat at tables before. They're too high for me. And he needed to be taller so his elbows could rest a little bit lower, but his elbows were too high at the table. So that was really just bugging me when I was watching it.
It looks like a little kid, like at dinner, like, I'm not.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not eating those green beans. I'm not eating those green beans.
Can somebody get Jay a booster seat here? Like,
yeah, I agree. No, there's so many acronyms for all these. Yeah, you know, we've got the LIV, PGA Tour, PIF. The what is it?
SSG.
SSG. Now it's like it's always these three letter acronyms, and it's just kind of like,
oh yeah, I don't know.
It's hard to keep up with. No, I agree. It's getting a little over the top.
All right, so let's get to another happy topic. LIV. AK plays well, doesn't finish last. Final round, 5 under. McLean, you said you watched some of it. You said you liked it earlier. Before we got on the pod,
I did. I did. I'll say I watch the front nine almost every night. It's funny because it kind of goes against what I just said about having a larger field, and I get it. And that's why I preface to say under the PGA Tour's current format, LIV's format's obviously very different. And the one thing I did enjoy was watching a ton of great players play golf. And it was just golf, golf, golf. They are moving from shot to shot faster than the PGA Tour has ever done before. And you get to watch a lot of good golf. I mean, it was good to watch. Hong Kong, that track was very difficult, especially if you're not driving it well. You drive it off the fairway, the woods are basically water. I mean, it is a penalty area. You miss it off those fairways and you are absolutely toast if you're not just barely into the rough. I enjoyed watching it. I mean, I'm going to be honest. I was actually a little bit surprised by it. It was also nice that, you know, sitting around late at night, there's golf, live golf to watch. They do have a pretty good roster at this point. It's where you do get to see a lot of top players that you used to like to watch. I've always loved watching Abraham Answer play golf. His short game is absolutely ridiculous. It is so good around the greens. Watching John Rahm, Dustin Johnson, Cam Smith, getting to see some AK golf shots was fun and unique. It's better now than it has been. I haven't watched much LIV in a while, but watching it the other night, I enjoyed watching it. I mean, they moved from golf shot to golf shot faster than any other television broadcast that I've ever seen. Do I think that it's all figured out and that it's getting ready to make this massive production of it? Not necessarily. But I will say, as a core golf fan and someone that follows the game pretty intensively, I did enjoy watching it. I enjoyed how quick the pace was. I enjoyed the amount of golf that I saw, the amount of different shots that I saw guys hit. And ultimately, I thought it proved to be very entertaining from a viewer.
I'm going to come at this from a negative spin.
Imagine that. Yeah, way to change it up, Mike.
No, so I haven't watched the last two events because I don't stay up that late and they're on the middle of the night. And so I'm just frankly, I'm not investing staying up late on that time in almost about anything in this point in my life, especially LIV golf. I did watch a fair amount of the first two events and my take doesn't really change all that much from what I've said. I think the announcers are annoying. The graphics can be good. Some of the data they give is good, but the graphics and the way they show them, I feel like it's going to get me ADD more than I might already have ADD. I actually wasn't as surprised the last event I watched of, I actually thought there was going to be more. There was a lot of those canned pre-produced bits where we're watching, you know, Cam Smith ride to the golf course on his bike and they're interviewing him. And then John Rahm's in a car with some guy named Kieran Vincent, some weird hair, you know, talking about the team strategy for the day. I'm like, I don't need to see this. The one thing I think is a lot of golf shots is good. I think the PGA Tour coverage on CBS and NBC, they struggle with too much commercial load is where they lose, you know, the quantity of shots. But I also want to hear like good breakdown of a shot. I don't want to see just swing after swing after swing. Like sometimes I want to hear like, what is this player trying to traverse here? What is this shot at hand? And let the commentators talk or hear the caddy player discussion and let it breathe a little bit, especially when it gets down to crunch time. Like if I'm just watching boom, 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 like, okay, cool. I watched Dustin Johnson hit a six iron, but I don't know. Tell me something about the shot. That's what I'll say.
I would like that. Like I would like all of the guys to be mic'd up on the last, like, I don't know, all of the winners, all of the leaders in the last like four groups. Hey, part of the live tour, you have to be mic'd up so we can hear when the time comes, we need to be available so we can hear the conversation. And I think that would kind of be cool to kind of get a little bit more of an insight on exactly what each player is saying. And I know they sometimes do that on the PGA Tour, but not to the extent of what they could, you know. And that would be kind of neat. Like now we're listening in to Jordan Spieth and what's Michael Greller. Like, and then on the other side we've got, you know, JT Poston, who won't say anything to his caddy. And it's like, okay, now we're going back and forth. Let's see how weird this is, you know. And then all of a sudden, JT's talking more than Jordan Spieth. What's going on here? Like, I don't know, just like that whole dynamic, something different, a little bit more of the insight. I think as a fan, we're always trying to look and find an edge. Like, hey, I'm going to take that to the golf course tomorrow. Like, man, I didn't realize they were talking about that. I didn't realize they were paying attention to that. They're paying attention to the, you know, the wind direction. They're paying attention to, you know, the lie, you know, and how they can cover this bunker. And I'm going to hit it right of this pin, you know, because of the bunker's back left or the pin's back left over this bunker. And I'm just going to lay out to the right because of the way the lie is set up or the wind or whatever it is. I mean, all these little things like add up, you know. I remember playing in the State Open. I guess it was probably 10 or 12 years ago now. But I had, you know, I ended up playing well and ended up winning that week. But I was sitting there with my cousin, my brother, and another good friend of my brother's. My cousin, Mikey Moyers, went on to play the web.com tour in his first year. It's just super talented guy. I mean, he could be playing on the PGA Tour right now. But needless to say, they were young. They were in college and we were going over the next round together. We were all kind of talking about it. And I was like, what's the wind going to be doing tomorrow? Like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, what direction is the wind blowing out tomorrow? Is it southwest? Is it, you know, is it northwest, east-west, you know, not east-west. Is it, you know, southwest? What is the wind direction? And at what time during the day is the wind going to be switching, you know? And they were like, what is wrong with you? Like, and I had my book out with my compass on it. And I was like looking at every hole and they're like, you're getting really detailed, Jay. Like, why are you looking at all that? I'm like, you need every little thing makes a difference. Every little bit counts. And you know, obviously they didn't give two shits about it and I ended up winning. I was like, there you go. That's why you focus on that shit.
Suck on that.
But I mean, hearing that stuff, I kind of went off, you know, on a tangent there, but hearing that stuff from the professionals, the guys who do it every day and what makes them great. Like, okay, I want to hear the inside scoop. Like it'd be like, listen to a quarterback talk to, you know, coach, like, what are you looking at on this play? And the same thing, like those are the little things that you want to hear. That's what makes it entertaining. So whether it's Live Tour or PGA Tour, if they both can find a way to do that more, I think it's, I think it's entertaining. It would make me watch more for sure.
I'm just excited. I'm looking at my Majestics. They finished fourth this week. They almost got onto the podium.
Is that your team, the Majestics?
I mean, that's what the team picker told me last year when I did it. So I'm just riding.
I think my team was the Cleeks. Are they in last place?
They're in 11th. We currently have a tie for last place between the Ironheads and the High Flyers. Mickelson's got some explaining to do.
He's hurting Miami. He's hurting his team.
I think there needs to be a shakeup there. I think he needs to be fired as team captain and manager and kick out the league.
Maybe.
Kick sure that'll happen.
Maybe.
Kick him off, Doug.
You know, Kevin Na, what are you doing, pal? Like, you can't lead your squad, and it's time to make a change. You know, management's got to step in and send a message to the rest of the locker room.
I do think that would take that tour to the next level if you just said,
there's even more shakeups. Yeah.
Yeah. We're kicking you off. You're off the tour. Like, when I heard stories of Brooks Koepka getting pissed about Matt Wolf and like kicking him off the team, I was like, oh, let me watch. Let me see what's going on. It was almost like we were watching, Real Housewives of, LA or whatever.
Or Orange County. Where I think if we were able to combine these tours and still keep it, might even be called Live Golf. You call it whatever you want, but you have a series where all the players are eligible. Now all of a sudden, and it could be, you call it the signature events, where you have a different format for these events. And now all of a sudden you're starting to see a much larger shakeup. Now I think it becomes a very entertaining product.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be cool.
It'd be awesome.
I don't think he meant that, Jay.
I don't think he meant that at all.
So be so cool.
That'd be so cool.
All right, let's get to our picks. Big event. Players, we've kind of already talked about the golf course a little bit and alluded to it. This is probably the hardest event of the year to make picks because nobody has a really good track record. I mean, you'll see guys miss the cut 3 years in a row and then have a T2. Like, it is just wild stuff. They'll win and then they'll miss the next two cuts and then they'll finish 50th and then they'll finish 8th. It's just, it's the... Like we said earlier, this course does not lend itself to any kind of style. We've seen pretty much every style of golfer win here. I've changed my team about 14 times. I started studying yesterday, and that was probably the wrong thing to do. I've talked myself in and out of about 25 players winning this golf tournament this week. So I do not feel confident in my team. One bit. Just don't feel good.
Well, speaking of that, I've played, or I shouldn't say played, but my team has been not great in the last 3 or 4 weeks. So, I mean, I have no clue what's going on. Every year I do this. I start off like the first 3 or 4 events. I do great. And then I hit this lull when we get to the West Coast or the Florida swing, and I finish last every week. I don't know what it is. But I'm hoping I can change this trend a little sooner. But this is a tough week for sure. You hit the nail on the head.
All right, McClain, you won last week.
I'd be happy to go ahead, boys.
Yeah. It's how we do it. You win, you go first.
All right, 6,300. I got two players down there. Lucas Glover, who I like.
Two players at 6,300.
Lucas Glover's just a ball striker. This golf course is a ball striker. Paradise, I think he's going to do well. 6,300, I've also got Andrew Putnam, guy that snuck in there last week for a top 10 finish. Moving forward, the remainder of these picks all come directly from the power rankings. You're welcome. I really don't understand why you guys don't look at this. Like, at this point, it's been a year and a half.
So I actually looked at it this week, and it's very different than you would think. I got to hand it to PJTour.com power rankings. They don't just have like 15 of the top 20 guys in the world on there. Like, it's some different.
They normally don't. They normally have some good picks in there. Moving up from there, 7,300, Erik van Rooyen. Rooyen, whatever you want to say. Then I go up to Russell Henley, who I think will do very well. He finished T19 last year. Sahith Theegala at 8,700. And then you can't not take the hot hand. Scotty Scheffler, $12,800.
I knew you were doing it when you said you had two guys at 6,300. I'm like, I had Scotty on his team.
Had to.
Get him in.
Had to. Got to get the guy on there.
All right. I'll go with my team that, again, I do not feel confident in. I'll start at my bottom. $6,800, Doug Gim. He's been playing well, and he has a decent track record at this golf course. You know, like I said earlier, not many do, but Doug Gim actually has a decent track record, and he's been playing well, so I'm going to take him at 6,800. I love the guy this week. Then I'll go up this week. Then I'll go up to 7,000, Cam Davis. I like his game. He hasn't done anything too flashy, playing solid. I just think his game can fit here. Then I'm going to go up to Emiliano Grillo, who's also having a sneaky, really sneaky good, you could call it, you know, not just 2024, but going back even into 2023. He won it Colonial last year, and so I like him. I think that's a good steal at 7,400. Then I go up to a pure ball striker, $8,300, Corey Connors.
Mm-hmm.
And then my two studs. I'll go with my high dollar guy first. Won here a couple of years ago, preeminent player in the world, $10,600, Justin Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
I think he likes this place. Again, has had a good year other than the Genesis as one little blip this year is Genesis. I think he has a very, very solid week. I think in top five for JT. And then I'm not going to miss it. I've done this before in the past where I predicted someone would win a golf tournament. They didn't, and then they won the next week. So I'm sticking with him. I said he was going to win last week. He had the lead on Saturday, gagged it. But $9,900, Will Zalatoris wins this week.
Yeah. Yeah, I can believe that.
I just talked myself into liking my team there.
Yeah, you did. You're very convincing. Very convincing.
That was more to myself than the viewers or the listeners.
All right. I'll zip through here at the bottom. $6,200. Hissatune. He's been playing great. 18th last week at the Puerto Rico Open. For a guy who hasn't played a whole lot of PGA Tour events, he's played some good events, made the cut and all of them. And, you know, a couple, you know, finishes not great. You know, the Phoenix Open and Cognizant, he kind of dropped off and finished towards the back. But, I mean, played some good golf. So at that price point, and he makes some birdies, so we'll give him a shot here. Jumping up, Adam Scott, $7,600. I know he didn't play well last week, but a really, really good track record on this golf course. So I'm hoping for him just a cut made, make some birdies, four rounds of making some putts. The same can be said for Tom Hoagie at $7,800. Again, one of these guys that just been playing good. Finished 12th last week, 28th at the Cognizant, 8th at the Genesis, 17th the Phoenix, 6th at the Pebble. I mean, guys just playing good golf, and it's $7,800. I mean, it's, again, I know this golf course is tough, but he's a great ball striker, and he's a good putter. He doesn't hit it very long, but we all know that that's not necessarily a prerequisite to play well at this golf course. Then I jump up to three guys that I think are going to be in contention again, based on their track record with tough golf courses and how they're playing and current form. At $9,100, Mr. Shane Lowry is playing some good golf. He can't seem to kind of get it done, but the last 2 weeks he's played great. He played great at the Farmers. It seems like he is trending in the right direction. He keeps putting himself in contention. So I'm going to ride the hot hand there. And if this turns into a semi fifth major, as it's been coined. We know how he does in majors, and if it's a tough test, then I would put him at the top. If it turns into a shootout and the conditions are easy, it may be a little tougher for him to compete, but I'm banking on it being really tough. It looks like, from what I've seen picture wise, they've got superior control over the grass and the growing conditions there, which in my opinion means they can do whatever they want. So I would venture to say that they're going to make it as tough as they can until they can't. So I like Shane Lowry there. Then I jump up to Max Homa, another player who plays great on tough golf courses and plays great on this golf course. He's had some success. I like him this week. And then last but not least, $100 above Mr. Max Homa, I'm going to ride the hot hand here, who has had flashes of brilliance, Mr. Wyndham Clark. We'll see what he does. It's kind of a gamble on that, in that price range, I'm not going to lie, compared to some of the other players. But if he is engaged and is on point, you know, I think he can play as good as anybody, as long as he hits it and as straight as he hits it. Good iron player. You know, at that price point, I had Jordan Spieth at $9,500, who's got a weird record there, and Colin Morikawa coming off of a miscut last week. You know, that's why I went with Mr. Wyndham Clark. So there you go. I mean, we'll see. This golf course is tough. I mean, it's just so freaking hard to figure out what people are going to do.
Yeah. So I'm excited. Yeah. Big full field event, strong field golf course. We all know a lot of drama on the golf course. So should be a good week. Yeah. Hopefully the golf course dries up. I know they've gotten a bunch of rain down there. It seems like the rough is lush, just like I like it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So, unless you guys have anything else, that's it for me, gents. We'll be back next week to discuss.
Later.
Enjoy it.
Cheers.